Bill Rainey for this week while he took a few days off. Get our report started, looking first at safety. I know many of you have been in the room before, but you should be reminded that should we have an emergency, the only way out is back through the door that you came in. So please take note of that exit. Your best exit out of the building would be down the stairs and out, but if that should be trapped off, you can go down the halls and out the end to the left once you get there. So please take note of that. Looking at the report itself, I'd like to draw attention to the fact that the large number of lost time accidents are really an accumulation from May 22nd. We did an audit last week of the logs we had, and for some reason about 34 of the lost time accidents didn't make it from the logs to this report, so we made that correction to ensure that the record was correct. If you look at the trend for the week, it's holding constant with about the last 5 or 6 weeks, so although we'd like to see it going down, we're not seeing any unusual trends in safety. I might, as far as issues in safety, remind you of two or three things. We have, in some of our areas in the cleanup operation, seen some increased bear activity. As a result of that, in those specific areas, we've taken some steps to increase the bear guards. And I think the places where that's happening, those people will be aware of that. It's not all over, but there were a few places where that was happening. Another issue in safety that came to us this week is the weather. We did have some unusual weather spring up, although we had some predictions it got worse than we expected in some places. So we have begun sending our observations in from around our operation several times a day so that if something is happening, we can get on top of it before it grabs us somewhere. We did, in some sensitive areas, for example, down in the Barren Islands, have a contingency plan for evacuation should bad weather come up, and we had to implement that twice while we've been working there. Everything's worked fine, so we feel real good about what we're doing there. The major change in training that we've done this week, that we prepared the bioremediation team for their work as they've started work yesterday, and that training went well, and we feel good about having those guys well protected in their business. And as far as a challenge in safety, I think each of us, as we represent our companies and our agencies, as we go out into the operations, need to understand that we are the company and we are the agency when we go, and the attitude they're going to pick up is the one we carry with us. So we want to make sure that we project the same thing that we expect them to do out there. And certainly from the reports we're getting, that's exactly what's taking place. Looking at the equipment, there are not a lot of changes in our operations from the previous week. We still have almost 1,300 vessels deployed and 36 skimmers working in our operation with 82 support aircraft, 278,000 feet of boom deployed as we've had in the past. This week we went above the 700-mile mark in beaches treated to the almost 705 miles, with 82 of that happening this week. We do have 75 cleaning vessels operating with 72 berthing vessels for people out in Prince William Sound and down in the Gulf of Alaska. We're cleaning, you can see, boom cleaned. About 15% of the boom that's in use is being re-cleaned and redeployed each week. And we are above 11,000 people working throughout our total operation. To give you a breakdown of what's happening in both Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska, we've again brought our task force commanders in. I'd like to turn the program over now to Wayne Voskamp, who will bring us up to date on his task forces.
I'm Wayne Voskamp with Exxon. I'm the coordinator for task forces 1, 2, and 6. I'll cover those areas and then turn it over to Bill Stillings, who will cover Task Forces 3, 4, and 5. Starting with Task Force 1, Task Force 1 has remained this past week in the southern sectors of the Sound, working primarily in the Evans Island area and Elrington Island. The tip of Evans can be seen here. Actually, Task Force 1 is beyond the map at this point in time. They have completed the northern portions of Elrington Island. Last week, received Coast Guard approval for demobilization on 13 segments. So at this point in time, they're more toward the south, working primarily handwork only, no washing, in the southern portions of Evans and Elrington Islands. As Don mentioned, the newsy item for Task Force 1 this week is the formation of the small work group doing bioremediation. This group was formed using the berthing vessel Glacier Bay Explorer and the Double Eagle. The first vessel was a part of Task Force 1. The other one came from Task Force 2. Group of about 60 people or so with three landing craft outfitted for a bioremediation application. Current location is right off of Green Island. At about this point, the initial work segment is GR1B. This is about a 1,600-yard segment, and at this point in time, the group has experimented with various techniques of application, have covered a little over 500 yards of this segment. They've been working with backpacks and with an all-terrain vehicle with a little trailer behind it that carries the fluid and has a spray header. At this point, we're encouraged with the way the all-terrain vehicle approach is working in that it is traveling well on this beach and doing a good job of applying the material, the fertilizer, to the beach area. Plans are to continue to finish GR1B, then move from there to GR1A, do that work later this week, and go ahead to other sectors as appropriate on Green Island to make application there. Moving along to Task Force 6 remains in the Ashami Bay region with the nucleus headquarters still anchored in Ashami Bay about this point. This task group is virtually up to full strength now with two Omni barges, two Maxi barges, and six landing craft. They are concentrating on Crafton Island and some of the other areas in the Ashami Bay area. Have had a good week with 12 segments approved this week for demobilization by the Coast Guard. The other task force, Task Force 2, has remained in the lower passage. New developments are underway with regard to Task Force 2. They are on the verge of completing all the remaining work in Lower Passage. They had, as you may recall, for several weeks been in the Upper and Lower Passage, and they're about to finish Lower Passage. And a new deployment scenario is on the horizon for this week. Their next location gets intertwined with some movements involving the other task forces, primarily Task Force 3. So at this point, I'll turn things over to Bill Stillings and let him cover the redeployment for all the task forces here in the Sound.
Thanks, Wayne. I'm Bill Stillings. I'm in charge of Task Forces 3, 4, and 5. As Wayne pointed out, over the last 2 weeks, the productivity has increased rapidly with the 24-hour operation on all our Omni and Maxi barges and the increased number of workforces in the field with the application and Task Force 6. Task Forces 3 and 2 have made good progress in their areas and are completing the initial treatments in these segments. In looking at the area that we have left to work in the remaining time this summer, it became apparent that the area on southeast, Knight Island is the one area that we need to move into. Our plan is to move Task Force 2 out of the Lower Passage area down into Snug Harbor. We're also almost simultaneously going to move Task Force 3 up into the Perry Island area to work Lone Island, which is one of the areas that we have yet to work, be positioned to work anything that remains on Coal Ross in the Dutch Group or Fool's Island up above that, which are currently being scattered. The way that move is going to occur, we're going to take one of the vessels out of Task Force 3, berthing vessels, and redeploy it with Task Force 2 to free up the Ogden. So right now we have brought in the berthing vessel Betty L. and have positioned it into the East Twin Bay currently. We have taken the personnel from the Midway berthing vessel and concentrated them on the C-411 in Task Force 3 here, and we are tonight moving the Midway up to East Twin Bay. When that is moved and secured and we have everything operational there, we're going to move the personnel and equipment from C-411 up to East Twin Bay, and Task Force 3 will be redeployed up there. That will leave the C-411 empty. We're going to move it around and position it into the bay here at Snug Harbor. Once that is done late this week, in the Thursday-Friday time frame, we expect to sail the Ogden and the Corinthian down and transfer personnel off the Ogden at this point, and then load the Navy skimmers onto the Ogden in that area. This will leave the Jan B berthing vessel in the upper passage in this location. We expect to reassign that vessel and its personnel to an increased size Task Force 4 then, and expand its area to any work remaining in the Task Force 4 and 2 area, predominantly Eleanor 109, which is this bay on the south side, which has a lot of work remaining. Task Force 4, with that increase, should be in a good position then to complete the work in the Northwest Bay area, the outside of Eleanor Island as the weather permits, and then pick up the 109 area and any work that may be left behind by Task Force 2 in a more efficient manner. Likewise, any work that should remain in the Task Force 3 area will be picked up by Task Force 5, which has made good progress all the way south in their segment and is working the north end of Chenega at this time. With that, are there any questions that either Wayne or I could answer for anyone? It's a lot of data in a hurry. Okay, with that then, I'd like to turn it over to the Gulf of Alaska.
Ken Lewis,
representing the Gulf of Alaska Force. Ken?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ken Lewis. I'm the coordinator for Gulf of Alaska activities, which are the areas outside of Prince William Sound. We have major operations at Seward, Homer, and Kodiak, and supply bases at Cordova and Whittier. Our estimate is that we have approximately 700 miles of total shoreline to be treated. This number could vary depending upon SCAT and other assessments which are now underway. We reached a major milestone today in that we have now treated over 500 miles of shoreline, and equally as importantly, we now have 100 miles of shoreline signed off. Manpower in the Gulf, we have 920 OSRT people directly involved in beach cleaning. We have 70 Exxon people, and in total, including all indirect people, we have 1,730 people in the Gulf of Alaska operations. In addition, we have 520 vessels. Going through area by area on highlights, in the Seward area, the assessment is 95%, and we expect to complete that around early August. Our total estimate of miles to be treated is 16, and we have treated 14 of those 16 miles. Our current operations, the highlights, we have completed training in the Seward area of the lander washing crews. Those units are now operating very well and successfully. We have 10 units working in the area as compared with two this time last week. The hot water washing is taking place at Morning and Wildcat Coves, and within 10 days we'll be moving on to other locations. We also plan bioremediation treatment in that area and have selected 8 sites for that treatment. Our estimate of work to be done in the area is 3,700 man days. We have 135 OSRT people in the area, and we will finish by August 31st treating the significantly impacted areas. Included in that schedule is an allowance for individual site mobilization, demobilization, and waiting on weather, and that will allow us some time to treat shoreline if there is any re-oiling. Moving to Homer, The assessment of areas there is 95%, and we'll complete that assessment by August 8th. Our total estimate of miles to be treated, 43, and we have treated 36 of those miles. The current operations, we are currently training the crews on the land of wash units. We now have 8 units in the Homer area. This time last week we had 3. The hot water washing is taking place at 2 locations. The major project in the Barron Islands is the Barron Islands. We have 45 people out there. We will be removing those people from the Barron Islands no later than the 14th of this month. We're not prepared to risk them beyond that point. Recent weather data shows, analysis of historical over the last 5 years, that we have around a 25% chance of 28-foot waves and or 60-knot winds. Our estimate of total work remaining in the Homer area is 3,900 man days. We have 171 direct OSRT people working in the area, and we will finish by August 31st treating significantly impacted areas. This once again includes the MOB, DMOB, waiting on weather, and will allow significant time to treat any areas that could become re-oiled. Dealing lastly with Kodiak, the assessment in Kodiak is 93% at this point. It will be completed very early September, around the 2nd. The estimate of total miles to be treated in Kodiak is 600 to 700, depending upon the current assessments underway. There are 4 SCAT teams in the area. We have treated a total of 550 miles. That includes some re-oiling. Kodiak Island is almost complete. The major work is on the Alaskan Peninsula on the southern side. The new resources that we've applied in Kodiak is 1 large berthing vessel, and we're now strengthening the communication so that we can work effectively when we cross over the strait onto the Alaskan Peninsula. Our estimate of work remaining is around 24,000 man days in the Kodiak area. We have 612 OSRT directly involved in shoreline cleaning, and the plan is to finish that early September and allow time to treat any areas that could become re-oiled. Quite recently, we have had some areas in the northeast end of Kodiak Island and slight re-oiling. Moving to another item which could very much affect our work plan, specifically in the Seward and Homer areas, is log burning. Just to recap on where we think we stand on this, in early June, the Coast Guard NOAA and the Homer MAC basically had agreed that burning of contaminated logs was a very viable proposition and the best option. A successful test was carried out at Rocky Bay on June the 11th. We thought that ADEC at that time had agreed that test was successful. But on July 18th, ADEC felt that further tests were required. However, on the 25th of July, ADEC did approve Barron Island to carry out log burning, which was a great help. The Barron Island log burning is complete. That was finished last night. It was very successful, we thought, and an ADEC representative did witness all of it. We do have outstanding requests for approval of further sites, both in Seward and Homer. However, the approval delays are now impacting upon our operations, and a key assumption of those is the efficient use of our resources. Our perception is that the decision-making process in some way is stalled, and we don't understand. Summarizing the Gulf of Alaska activities, we have updated work plans in all of the areas. These plans have been reviewed with the Coast Guard here in Valdez, with their representatives in Seward, Homer, and Kodiak. We believe that we now have a very common view of the scope of work to be completed and the treatment methods to be carried out. This will allow us to continue to deploy resources in the most efficient way as possible. We are preparing, in some cases, operating contingency and emergency plans for possible severe storm conditions during August and September. I would like to mention that at this time last week when I was here in Kodiak, we had 11 miles signed off. Today we have 76 miles of shoreline signed off. In Seward this time last week we had 6 miles signed off. Today we have 13 miles, a total of 100 miles. This has really been brought about by the Coast Guard, who have made an extraordinary effort to arrange the resources, and we do appreciate it. It really is allowing us to move on. It's quite significant in our progress. The overall plan allows completion by September 15th, and in that schedule, as I mentioned before, there is sufficient time to do retreatment of re-oiled areas. For those of you who didn't understand anything I said, in the Exxon handout, there's a translation from Australian to American. I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
This is Jeannie from CDFU. I had a question of a report that was made in DEC's, I think it was July 26th report about Grungy Cove in Homer, about the creek being dammed up and the water used to clean the beaches. You know, it's an Andromus fish stream. Do you know anything more about that?
I'm not aware of that, but I will find out the answer and get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank Steve, you. Steve, do you want to address that burning issue while we're in as much as the question's on the table?
Certainly. Letter from Exxon did come into us July 27th, and we will have a response back or with approval to burn this evening if we can get it, or tomorrow morning, depending on when you want it. No, I'll...
let's see.
I don't have any blank paper with me. Right? No, but we will get that out just as quickly as we can. So,
okay.
Thumbing over in our report to page 9, quickly looking at our waste management activities, we are still disposing of about 200 to 300 tons of solid waste today, and cumulatively over 14,000 tons today. Looking in the sanitary wastewaters, since our aerated treatment lagoon has been approved, we're now processing about 200,000 gallons a day of sewage there. On the oily solid waste, we're still anticipating permits for our two incinerators. We have expanded our chem waste management plant in Seward, where we're grinding up oily solid waste to take to landfill, and we went to a second shift there yesterday. We have moved our Sealy incinerator barge to location out in Herring Bay, and we've not yet deployed a ET incinerator to its location. We have had some issues this week concerning fish, and I thought I'd take time to let Bob Mastracchio bring you up to date on what we've been doing recently in that area.
Okay, we had a closing of the fishery around the Esther Hatchery over the weekend. We have a lot of conflicting information from a number of sources. The first we learned about it was a couple of vessels going into Whittier, claiming that they had contaminated catches. So far, to the best of our knowledge, we can find no evidence of contamination from any of the vessels or the catches in Whittier. Can't find any hydrocarbon or samples. Some other vessels came into Cordova. Samples were taken of what appeared to be hydrocarbon, and they were shipped up to Valdez for analysis. NOAA is conducting the analyses. A number of parties have samples, ADEC, ADFNG, Exxon, NOAA. So there are going to be a lot of cross-checks on these samples. Several samples have been run so far, and again, there's been nothing to indicate that crude oil is the source of the contamination, if there is contamination. NOAA informed me, I think last night or early this morning, that some number two fuel oil was found up in Unakwik. And that's an area that there was never any crude oil from the spill, and the same in the Cog Hill, Esther Island District. So we really need to get a little more information and try and sort this out exactly what happened. Meanwhile, we've been taking the fish, because the fish has been spoiling, even though it's not adulterated. Since we have the facilities for it, we are washing boats, cleaning nets, and, you know, using the facilities we have at our disposal. But I just want to emphasize right now there's no evidence that it's crude oil.
There's still some bilge pumping going on out there, and I don't know how to control it. When I flew in from Cordova the other day, I flew over one of the bays, and it was obvious to me that that was far from an oil spill, and what looked like bilge slops were floating around out there. So we've got to watch that closely. We would like to have any of those reported that are seen. We'll try to track them down. It's awful difficult to track a spiller in that case.
Well, Admiral Robbins, with the rest of the data that's included in our report, I think that concludes our report this evening.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you.
Okay. Like our aerial surveillance in the sound has shown that there's still oil bleeding off of Smith, Seal, and Perry Islands. I guess that is of concern to us, especially since some of these areas are going to, it looks like the only future treatment they'll get this year will be the bioremediation. So we really want to take a close look at those and be able to, we feel there's going to be a real need to have to deal with those in the wintertime, because we think we'll see significant oil off those. So,
One of the, addressing Perry Island specifically, that's one of the reasons we moved Task Force 3 back up in that area. We do feel there is additional cleaning that should be done in that area around Perry Island before the end of the year. We're looking very hard at Smith Island at this time as a possible place to move Task Force 5 to. You know, I think we'll have that decision resolved this week, but we're giving that real serious consideration for the Director of May coming in here in the near future.
Thanks, Bill.
With regard to the air incineration permits, Brad Fresco, do you want to give a rundown on the status on those, please?
My name is Brad Fristo, and I'm the coordinator for the waste management issues. And as of yesterday, the public notice period for the barge incinerators was completed. We have received a number of comments from the public towards the end of the comment period. We have gotten some from Exxon in the last few days that also presented new information. We are evaluating that and looking at the draft permit that we have drafted up, and our attorneys are also looking at that, and we expect by the end of the week that we will be issuing a permit.
Even with attorneys looking at it? No problem. Okay. That's good.
I guess we already talked about the Barren Islands and driftwood burning out in the Longwood Gulf, so hopefully we'll get that, we'll have that resolved first thing in the morning, so by getting a permit over, or actually a letter, it'll really be a letter of approving the burns. So I guess the other item that we wanted to talk about tonight was and it's really been covered already, I guess, so that pretty much concludes our report, I think.
Good.
So.
Okay. Coast Guard?
I'm Jake Rowe with the Coast Guard. Our format is the same. The first couple, three pages are summary information of miles signed off, personnel, and equipment. There is a write-in addition to the first, as a first issue for us. Friday, August 4th is our 199th birthday. So if you see a Coastie, pat him on the back and say happy birthday. 10 money. Well, I don't think so much of us in here, but we got, I met a young lady today that she's on her 35th day on a fishing boat as a monitor. Had a day off and is back out tonight for another 30 days. So, they're working hard out there.
Yeah, they are.
As mentioned, the Ogden is being relieved and will be departing over the next weekend. And the Admiral has attended a couple of conferences and is doing some more hearings and that portion of his job, which I am pleased he has and not I. The immediate next page requires a bit of explanation, but I think if you can read the pie chart, it will help you gain focus on the efforts that are being made in the Prince William Sound area particularly. Yes, sir. We have reworked our cameo data and tried to depict the amount of the total work remaining to be done that is heavily oiled in the beach areas in scattered miles. And the second chart, the one immediately below, shows that same figure as a percentage of the total work units instead of in miles. So with about 75% of the remaining scattered miles heavily oiled, it equals in excess of 90% of the remaining work. Okay. Now both of those are in progress figures. So you can conclude from that that we have the current workforce focused on about 90% of the remaining work to be done. Okay. That hold together okay?
Yeah, that's as clear as a page.
Puddle of obscurity.
If there are any other questions.
There is a question concerning signing off of miles that have received no treatment. I noticed that it's still in your diagram, which is a little misleading for, I just happen to be working with Stewart and the Homer offices and working through some of the numbers. I'm wondering if you're going to be continuing with this same premise or if we open a dialogue about getting really sections that truly treated and signed off in the same way.
If the Shoreline Committee from whichever sector, if their recommended treatment is no treatment, then that gets inspected and signed off and counts.
And if it was no oiling, therefore no treatment?
Then it's zeroed out and it does not reflect.
So you say this was, just getting the story straight, that this had received oiling, at least we think it had received oiling, and therefore it was recommended no treatment and therefore was signed off?
That's correct. Yeah, we did have a period where we had some segments in the Seward area that came through, were reported as signed off. We entered them in, and it took us a while to figure out that the mismatch in the figures was because there was no scattered mile or impact mile in there to get signed off, so they didn't balance. And then we found it and we corrected for that.
Any other questions? Okay, thanks, Jay. You had nothing special to present tonight, eh? No?
We have a special report tonight that Ann Walker will present.
Ann? We're ready. She's shooting it. Okay. She's in there.
Okay, if we could turn the lights down a little bit, we're going to do it via our trusty Macintosh. I'm Ann Hayward Walker. I'm with the NOAA Scientific Support Team, and I'm here to tell you tonight about the interim results of what we call an oil productivity study. We undertook this study a few weeks ago to look at the factors that have an effect on the efficiency of cleanup. We proposed in looking over some of the shoreline treatments that were being done that it would be good to see exactly if there was any relationship between how long you clean a shoreline and what kind of oil recovery you're actually getting, and also if you could look at what kind of effects it might have on the biological resources in a given segment of beach. So we proposed that this would be a good thing to undertake, and Exxon concurred, so we undertook this joint study with Exxon Operations and Exxon Environmental and ADEC. At Admiral Robbins' request, we gave an interim report to Exxon and the Coast Guard about a week ago, and at his request, we wanted to share that with you tonight. Next one, Ellen. As we mentioned already, we wanted to assess the efficiency of oil recovery from shoreline treatment methods, and we wanted to look at the relationship of biological impact to intensity of treatment. I'd like to say that the biological impact assessment takes longer than our part of it, because you have to go back after the treatment 7 days later and see what kind of, whether the animals are still living, animals and plants are still living, or if they're not living, and make some conclusions and do a lot of counts. So their results will probably be presented next week. Next one, please. Next slide, please.
That's it.
You mean that's, oh, that's it, okay. The participants, as I mentioned, were NOAA, Exxon Operations, Exxon Environmental, and ADEC. Under Exxon Environmental, we had several groups involved, too. Dames and Moore with their consultants. America North participated in Ed Owens. So we had three different groups under Exxon Environmental. Let's see. I'd like to mention, too, that we did plan this jointly. And right now, as I mentioned, we're only talking about the NOAA report and the part that we did in cooperation with Exxon Operations. We went through and selected the site according to a number of criteria. We wanted to look at a shoreline type that was fairly typical of a number of the beaches that were oiled in Prince William Sound. And this meant it would be a cobble, mixed sand, and gravel beach. We wanted to, in this test, have a minimal effect on operations. We didn't want to disrupt any schedules because this is pretty massive equipment, as you're familiar, and interfering with their schedule would be really contradictory to what any of our goals. We also wanted to find a beach that would be have enough oil on it where you could actually get some quantification, if possible, of how much oil you were recovering. And we wanted to have a size of test site that would allow several different segments to be evaluated, and therefore they would have to be of somewhat similar in nature so that you could make comparisons of apples and apples. Next slide, please. Our limitations, however, are that, we must have gone by one, that the study area was probably too small. The site that we selected is this segment on Knight Island, number 113. It's in the north east corner. And originally we had three sites mapped out. There was another one that, if you look at 1 and 2, was just south. It had a gap of a couple hundred feet in between it. After surveying the site, we found that it was really not appropriate in terms of our criteria for homogeneity. So we had to drop it down on the final test to sites 1 and 2, which were side by side and fairly homogeneous. We found, as a matter of fact, that from a physical standpoint, they were fairly homogeneous, but from a biological standpoint, they really were not. So that will skew a little bit of the biological results that you see next week. The study area, unfortunately, has a limitation in that it is not a typical Omni site, although the site we wanted to look at was typical in terms of the number of beaches, the majority of beaches that have been oiled. The Omni boom really is more effective and used on more of a rocky shore. I should say here why we selected the Omni barge, and that has to do with the fact that you can calibrate the Omni cleanup method better than you can the other methods. In other words, if you're working with maxi barges, you've got a lot of human discretion involved in how much water and pressure and how long you apply treatment to a given sector. With the Omni boom, you can really calibrate things much better. You can look at the temperature. You've got a way to record some of the variables on the method side. The other reason that we selected is because with the feedback we've been given from the field, it's much more effective than they believed in recovering and removing oil from the shoreline and recovering it. So we wanted to, again, get a good idea of, is this a very efficient method in terms of recovering oil and removing it from the shoreline? As I mentioned a moment ago, the other problem with the study area is that it was somewhat more variable than we thought when we first went out and looked at it. But again, in the interest of time and wanting to do a study and get some results back to people and not interfere with operations, this site was considered heavily oiled and it was ready to be cleaned up in the next week or so. We decided that all in all, it was one that we should go ahead and continue with our study. Next slide, Ellen, please. This will give you a little bit of a view on our quantified results. Just to walk you through this a little bit, up at the top, you'll see when we began the two tests, you saw that there were two test segments. The first one began washing at 5:40 in the morning, and we washed it for approximately 2.5 hours until approximately 8:40 in the morning. We also, as you'll notice there, there was a little bit of a delay in skimming, and that primarily is because it takes a few minutes once you begin treating it for the oil to come off the beach and move into place where the skimmer can recover it. The second wash began at approximately 20 after 1 and continued for half the time approximately, or about an hour and a half. It's important to note, I guess, that the tide was considered in this. We wanted to wash it so that you would be able to get down to a low tide, so you get a large area of the beach that you could wash. So we began roughly on the first one four and a half hours before low tide and washed for 2.5 hours. So we stopped about 2 hours before low tide. The reason for that being that the water there was very shallow and it wasn't appropriate to keep the Omni barge there in shallow water, washing all the way down to actual low tide. So we modified our plan to begin cleaning the other one on the rising tide about 2 hours after low tide, so that both of them, the lowest segment that was washed, began and ended about the same area. In terms of oil that was recovered, you'll notice that what we've done is given you just in words what our total recovery was for each of the two tests. The first test, which was a longer test, we recovered 85 gallons, and the second test we recovered a total of 213 gallons. You'll see on the next slide when we get there, not yet Ellen, but on the next one, you'll see why we believe that is. The other thing I guess that we'd like to point out on this one is that we believe that after about the first hour and a half on both sites, even though they were washed for longer periods of time, you got the bulk of the oil that you were going to get off the site was washed into the water and recovered. So we thought that was pretty significant. After an hour and a half, you got a fairly dramatic reduction in the oil recovery. Another piece of information worth noting is that according to the two crews that were working the Omni at the time, they said that their normal way of cleaning the site probably would have been from 2.5 to 4 hours. So under their normal working conditions, they would have spent a little longer there than they did on this particular situation. And we think it's interesting to note that, in fact, they probably could have spent less time and gotten nearly the same amount of oil. So in this sense, we feel that if you can consider this an appropriate measure of shoreline treatment and recovery, your sort of cutoff point for high efficiency is about an hour and a half. Next one, please. This gives you a little bit of breakdown. We went through several different steps in arriving at this information. The first thing we did was to go out and try and estimate how much oil was actually on the shoreline. And this is the part of the test that all four groups participated in. ADEC did one calculation, we did one calculation, Ed Owens and his group did another calculation, and American North also participated in that. Their information will be ready later on, but we think it will be very interesting to see how well our various methods of estimating the oil on the shoreline coincide. For the 2.5 hour site, we estimated that 152 gallons were present prior to the test. And and the subsurface amount, which would be the sand and gravel beneath the upper part of beneath the surface, there were approximately 394 gallons. So you can see that we believe that the majority of the oil on that given segment of beach was in the subsurface. On the 1.5 hour site, you'll notice that there was more oil to begin with. And you can see it out to the end of the slide there, that's why you would recover. That's another reason why, even cleaning it for a shorter amount of time, you would recover more. This amount of oil recovered is what was actually measured in the EGMAPOL skimmer. We took interim measurements about every 15 or 20 minutes and multiplied that out with the variables supplied by the manufacturer for what equivalent amount of product that is. It's important to note that the amount recovered here and the percents noted are for oil and water together. If you were to figure it out just for oil, it would be about a third less. So for all our numbers, we figure the weathered oil and everything combined, it does include water. If you're actually going to calculate it strictly for oil, it would be about a third less. This is what numbers actually, if you translate it from the EGMAPOL, what we actually found. It's a pretty complex method that we used in calculating how much oil was on the surface and in the subsurface, and we're going to describe that in greater detail. I know we don't really need to do that here, and it's much more interesting when you've got drawings and pictures to explain it. So that will be in a report that we're preparing that we'll issue in the next few days. We also believe that there's a caveat on this, and that is that our numbers are probably not much better than a factor of 2, in spite of the sort of painstaking method that we went through in calculating it. So in terms of if you were looking at a total amount of oil, you could really figure it'd be somewhere between 250 and 1,000 gallons on that particular segment. Next slide, please. These are our interim findings, and I guess the first one we'd probably modify a little bit more, and we'd say that the most recovery really occurred in the first hour and a half of washing, and 2/3 of the oil was contained in the underlying sand and gravel. We did recover a lot of what was on the surface, but we believe there's still quite a bit there in the sediments. And in fact, if we went back and did a more detailed study follow-up, that it may be that there was you might have some of it that was, you might have more in the subsurface. The biologists are looking at that. They believe that there's probably there'll be some problems from the biological side associated with the subsurface oil.
You mean we're washing it down into the soil?
Possibly, yeah. The oil recovery averaged, if you took an average of all those numbers, 22% of the total available, and more like 17% if you factor out that the water makes up part of that 22%. Most of the recovery, as I mentioned, appeared to be from the surface rocks and cobble. Again, this could be off a little bit, but we feel that this seems about right given the visual observations for a number of people who have gone back to look at the beach following the treatment. So all these numbers do jive pretty well with what our visual observations by a number of people have given us. Our conclusions, next slide please, are pretty much what we've said already, that we feel that most oil recovery occurs from the surface sediments and that diminishing returns are reached fairly early in the omnibarge operations. The other thing, I guess, that we found is that most of the people in the field know pretty much how to operate the equipment effectively. It's possible that some, if you're looking at recovery rates and treatment and biological damage, that there could be some variation in how the crews really perceive how they operate their equipment. And we would probably reinforce what they already know, and that is to keep the head moving and not to leave it in one place, that you don't gain anything else by leaving the head in one place for a longer period of time. And in fact, you probably don't need to leave it in one place any longer than about a minute, and just to keep rotating it rather than to let, you know, not just up and down, but actually side to side when it's moving. And we think that one reason why you may also get the oil recovery pretty quickly in the first hour and a half is because once the surface of the rocks heats up to the point where the oil will move, then it in fact does move, and it begins to flow and you can recover and you don't need to stay there and work the beach for a long period of time. So if that's pretty much summarizes what we've done, and if anybody has any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Yeah. Did you make any attempts, or was it part of your study, to look at how much sediment may have come off the beach with the Omni operation?
Yes, we did, and that's part of the work that the biological people will summarize. Yep.
I'm sorry, I must have missed something. Could you tell me what variable you were comparing between the 2.5 hour wash and the 1.5 hour wash, and why the 1.5 hour had such a greater recovery? What was the comparison between those two tests besides time?
Well, the time was the main one.
Okay, so why didn't the 2.5 hour one include the reduction that the 1.5 hour did plus additional?
Well, we think originally, if we backed up to the, I think if we go back to Ellen, that one there, whoops, you'll notice on the 2.5 hour site that it had less oil to begin with. And so we think, you know, when we did our survey and we started tabulating the numbers, that the reason you recovered less even over more time is because there was less there to begin with. There's quite a bit of, again, when you first go out and look at the sites, they look fairly similar, but there's an awful lot of flushing. Did I not answer your question?
You did. I don't get the point of the comparison, because if there was less there, then of course you recovered less. You know, it's a good empirical study, and it's nice to know that a certain amount comes off after a short period of time and a diminishing return. Beyond that.
We didn't know that until we did the study, so that was...
Ma'am, do you have post-treatment sediment analysis, that is the surface and subsurface analysis?
You mean in the same way where we estimate exactly what's there?
Yes, well, you've got the pre-treatment analysis for that. I'm sorry, I missed whether you went back and analyzed the...
For the subsurface sediments.
Subsurface and surface after the treatment.
We did go back and take rock samples, and they're in the process of being analyzed. What we've done is taken large rocks and having the oil dissolved up those rocks, representative rocks, and we've got a method for, you know, estimating the percent coverage of the beach and everything. And that's how we estimated what was on the surface. And then for the subsurface, we took several cores and took samples back and estimated what percent volume of oil was in those sediments. So that's how we derived these numbers, and we went back following and got more samples, not as many, but more samples, and those are in the process of being analyzed in the lab, and that's why they're not included here. Interim report.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
One of our big concerns right along has been is how much washing we do and what kind of damage we're doing by staying there longer, and we can wash the dickens out of a beach. Are we getting diminishing returns rather early? And that's what we're trying to figure out, and what happens to the sediments and how much damage we're doing with washing sediments down in below the water level. And frankly, we're still searching around to see what we have, and we've got a ways to go. Did you have anything else, Dave?
Have the shoreline do a separate shoreline committee with a separate report?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, Jeannie, did you have anything tonight?
The only comment I wanted to make as far as the...
Give her a mic. Oh.
As far as, I don't want to dwell on something since the jury's still out on the closure of the fishery, but I do want to make a comment. I didn't appreciate the comment that Cordova was mentioned and bilge waters pumped out all in the same breath. And number two is that...
Oh, I didn't mean to make any comparison.
And number two is that if the DEC reports are read prior to the opening of the fisheries, you will see that there were reported sheens in that area of the fisheries. That's all I have.
Okay. Okay, thanks, Janine.
Do we know if they were crude oil or diesel oil?
We don't know.
That's important.
Like I said, the jury's still out, but
yeah.
They were just reports, and I don't take any samples for taste.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to just pursue it a little more. The issue seems to have flared up. There were a couple of reported incidents, and then, you know, it just kind of snowballed. And here in Valdez, a couple of vessels came in with reported contamination. And the last report I had is appears to be hydraulic oil. I guess the point I'd like to make is that there's an awful lot of hydrocarbon on these vessels, either in the form of hydraulic oil, diesel oil, lubricating oil, grease, dirt, and trying to distinguish that from crude oil and closing a fishery down is very difficult. And I think we've got to be very careful before that kind of an action is taken, because it's hard to reverse.
I suggest that perhaps if we looked at all of the operations under a microscope as we're doing right now, we probably would we would not be satisfied with the results in terms of the amount of oil that's kicking around in various places. And we are, those are the kind of things that come out in a spill like this. We really look at things closely and we discover things that we never knew existed. I don't know how you combat that. That's just kind of smile and live through it as best we can, I think. Shoreline Committee. Prince William Sound, Shoreline Committee.
During the last week, the Shoreline Committee has been reviewing the proposal that Exxon presented last week on the use of bioremediation as a treatment for oiled shorelines. As part of that, the committee during the reviews has come up with a recommendation that bioremediation be used as a treatment. This recommendation includes the recommended approach for site selection, protection of areas of concern, and application criteria and equipment. This recommendation was forwarded through the FOSC to the RRT today, and bioremediation as a treatment has been approved by the RRT. What I'd like to go through now are how these guidelines for the site selection and protection of areas of concern have been developed. And then after that, that'll be presented by Shannon Kniff of our committee. And then after that, briefly, I'd like to go through how we propose to work with Exxon to implement this treatment, which has already begun. Shannon?
Good evening. Before I start with an introduction of how the Shoreline Committee got to where it went today, I'd like to start with where EPA came from. EPA wrote a letter to Exxon on the bioremediation process, and among the items that are identified in that letter, one was that moderately and heavily oiled shoreline should be physically treated or cleaned prior to application of the bioremediation, and two, that cobble, sand, mixed sand, and gravel shorelines should be the subject of the bioremediation. EPA's letter also identified that there was the potential for nutrient enhancement and toxicity to marine life from the application of the fertilizer, particularly in protected, poorly flushed embayments. Especially when there was a situation where you'd have a large portion of that embayment, the shoreline, covered with oil being treated, and there was a small amount of surface area for that treatment, the fertilizer, to be washed into. So this led the ISCC to have some concern about how do we identify where there might not be adequate flushing. And one of the first things we did, with the assistance of Exxon, primarily EPA and NOAA, we put together some real crude number crunching. I wouldn't even call them models, per se. And the first step, what we did is we said, gee, what would happen if we had a chunk of shoreline, we sprayed it, and everything diluted into the water column right above that when the tide came in? It should be 100% dilution. And what we did was we figured out the concentration of that, the fertilizer, which is our key concern here, if it all washed off, let's say over a 100-meter stretch of beach, and an area right by shore about 10 meters wide. We got a concentration level of approximately 450. You don't need to worry about the numbers. I won't bore you with them. But for the sake of this particular number, what does that mean in the scheme of things? It's a number of 450. Well, for comparison purposes, EPA had generated some toxicity, initial toxicity information, utilizing mussel larvae. And they came up with called an LC, lethal concentration 50, which is the concentration in a laboratory test where 50% of the animals die. And the LC 50 was 50 milligrams per liter of the fertilizer. Now, I'm not a toxicologist, and so I mean, so what does that mean? We have 50, we have 450. The standard for comparison is that you take 10% of the LC 50, and you would use that concentration as the standard that you would not want to exceed, which in this case would be approximately 5 milligrams per liter. And that would take into account, even though we tested mussel larvae, that there are potentially other species out there that might even be more sensitive than mussel larvae. Mussel larvae themselves are, in fact, supposed to be very sensitive, or more sensitive than fish. So that's one way to take into account what might be the impact, let's say, to salmon fry without testing salmon fry directly. So 450 is two orders of magnitude greater than 5, certainly would mean that you had a concern. But assuming that the fertilizer is placed in the species and entirely washes away in an instant is not a real-world circumstance here, particularly since the fertilizer is, one, a slow-release fertilizer, and two, is designed to stay on the beach. Also, that's not very real-world is we haven't taken into account the fact that there would be dilution through natural mixing, through tidal changes. So let's say that it diluted on its own to a 100-meter-wide stretch. You would increase the dilution area tenfold, so your factor 450 would decrease by tenfold, so you get to 45. 45 is still bigger than 5. Let's say rather than just looking at the top 1 meter of the